Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking about your pet's dental health. And we have Dr. Christopher Snyder with us to answer your questions. He's the UW School of Veterinary Medicine's Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs and Director of the UW Veterinary Care. So, are you wondering why your dog has bad breath? Tell us how you're convinced your cat that brushing their teeth is okay. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Christopher Snyder, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Larry. Fantastic to see you and hear from you, and happy to be here.
Tell us more about what you do at UW Veterinary Care. What's a day-to-day look like?
Yeah, sure. So kind of a day-to-day for me, I wear two hats, right? So I'm serving as hospital director, and that's the lion's share of my work year. And then the other part of the time I'm wearing my clinic hat. So, you know, as a clinician in the teaching hospital, which is obviously the client facing piece for my role as a veterinary dentist, it usually starts with getting in the hospital close to 8 a.m. I work with a fantastic team of veterinary nurses and residents who are basically graduate veterinarians who are in training for specialty certification in dentistry and oral surgery. And, clinic days, we receive our patients in the morning. They come in, they receive some pre-anesthetic medications, and then they hit the table for us for cleaning, oral exam, dental x-rays, and then we're in touch with the clients to see what treatment options look like. And, you know, like a lot of things in human dentistry as well, you know, I can only do so much as a surgeon or as a dentist, and a lot of it comes down to what can the client do as far as maintaining that healthy, comfortable mouth for our patients when they're done. And then pretty much our day is done closer to five or six.
Well,
and that's way more exciting than when I'm wearing my administrative hat, which is pretty much a lot of computer work and meetings and emails. So.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about my own teeth. You know, we worry about our own teeth, and I'm not sure we worry as much about our pet's teeth. And dental care is really important for our pets.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I've been here at UW since I did my residency training from 2005 to 2008. And, you know, really what I've seen is, about that time that I started, there was a big movement from pets being, you know, living outside, tied up, having a doghouse, or cats living in barns, to really becoming four-legged members of the family. And, you know, it's pretty common now that our pets sleep with us, and you know, when their face is right up against ours, all of a sudden our awareness for their bad breath gets become acutely aware. And with that, I would say too, you know, clients' expectations of what gets done with their pets' dental recommendations has really changed a lot too over these last 20 or 30 years. What I've experienced is we'll contact a client, talk about a tooth that maybe has a lot of disease or infection, maybe painful, and, you know, offer up options that include removal or extraction. And clients will say, you know, when I had a similar problem with my tooth, and my dentist really emphasized we should try to save it. So the awareness for what the options are and the importance of the function of teeth and that they need to be comfortable and pain-free is of utmost importance in a lot of people's minds.
You look at cats' teeth and dogs' teeth, they're different. Are they similar in terms of care and everything else?
They are. I think a big difference is that, you know, people, we're grazers, so we're eating food all throughout the day, we're drinking sugary drinks, we're constantly providing the bacteria that live in the mouth with a source of carbohydrates, which is where they do all their dirty work. So, you know, the importance for getting in there and brushing our teeth, disrupting the plaque bacteria that's there once or twice a day, is really important to helping maintain a good distribution. If left to its own devices, the same thing can happen in dog or cat's mouths as well, where the good bacteria kind of get overridden by the bad ones. And that's when we start to see things like infection and attachment loss.
Yeah. Stephen Green Bay has a question for you about his corgi, I think. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. Thank you very much. Yeah, I've got about a six-year-old corgi who is light of my life, but has the swamp mouth to end all sanity. This dog just, it is ripe. But we took her in to see the vet and said that she might have some undeveloped or underdeveloped, like, baby teeth that hadn't come out. And we've been doing brushing, but it's taken a bucket to the beach. And I feel like I need some other alternatives to, like, what options, maybe dietary changes, or what we can do to help her out.
Sure. So you said your corgi is six. Has your corgi had a dental cleaning under anesthesia before?
One, yes.
Okay. So I typically try to explain it to clients a little bit like this. What you want to do is you want to make sure that the mouth is happy and healthy and is not painful when we start instituting home care efforts like toothbrushing. So most of what, and this is kind of a dirty little secret in veterinary medicine, and that's the calculus or the tartar that you see on the crowns of the teeth. This is what, as veterinarians, this is what we're pointing out to clients and helping justify why a cleaning is necessary. But the reality is those bacteria that are contributing to the swamp mouth and also contributing to pain and discomfort, those bacteria all live below the gum line. So I would absolutely always start a workup in a case like this with get the pet under anesthesia, do a good oral exam, a good cleaning above and below the gum line, and take x-rays. You know, make sure that if there's anything that's uncomfortable, we need to address that before we can really get good buy-in from the pet with a toothbrush. Because the last thing I'd want a client to do, and I tell this to my vet students as well when I talk about the importance of home care, is the last thing I want is a client to introduce a toothbrush and have that go into a pet's mouth and have there be some source of discomfort there. Because as soon as that toothbrush hits it, that pet's mind is going to think that this toothbrush is painful and they're not going to buy into the brushing piece after that. Once you kind of get that level playing field that everything in the mouth is as healthy and happy as it can be, certainly toothbrushing is like the gold standard for what we recommend to help maintain a healthy oral cavity or mouth. And then there's other pieces that we can sprinkle in there too. Like we can do dental diets. There are certainly chews, treats, and toys that are proven to reduce plaque and tartar buildup. So there's really a huge armamentarium of things we can use. I wouldn't say that retained baby teeth is likely to be the cause of the smell. My guess is there's probably some more bad bacteria hanging out below the gum line contributing to that smell.
So a dental cleaning would be appropriate from the sound of it in this case. How often should we be doing it? A dental cleaning, you know, as you know, take the animal to the vet and have a dental cleaning.
Yeah, a lot of that kind of plays into that pet's propensity or predisposition to develop bad periodontal disease. So most dogs, we're going to say yearly. Bigger dogs tend to go a little bit longer. They could probably go almost 2 years between cleanings. And then some small breed dogs, you know, sometimes they need it twice a year in order to stay ahead of the infection and pain.
Hmm. Steve, there you go. Something to think about. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Treble in Lodi, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Treble.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a good story for you. I had a 70-pound Canadian Eskimo dog that came from Baffin Island in Canada. And this dog, we were very active. We did ski joring, running, usually a couple times a week. And this dog, I gave I would get a T-bone steak once a week or twice a week, once every couple of weeks. And I would eat the small tenderloin piece of it, and I would give the whole rest of the steak and the bone to my dog. And she would just light up, and she would take that piece of meat and bone to her mat, and she would eat the whole thing down to, except for like a piece of the bone at the center of the tea, maybe the size of a quarter, and that would be left. But she would eat the whole thing. And after she was about 5 years old, I remember taking her to the vet and for an annual checkup. And the vet asked me, how do you keep your dog's teeth so clean? And I said, well, it's a T-bone steak a day.
Wow. What do you think about that, Dr. Snyder?
Oh, my root canal red flags are going up all over the place. So, I think that there is, there is a large group of pet owners that I think feel pretty comfortable recognizing that, you know what, if these dogs or cats lived in the wild, they'd be responsible for, you know, eating raw meat, chewing through bones, capturing their prey even. I think we know a couple of things. We know that these, wild animals don't live nearly as long as our domesticated pets do, and the advent of the commercial pet foods has really contributed a lot to systemic general health and other improvements that have increased the longevity of their lives. There's a really good rule of thumb when it comes to giving your pets things to chew on, because I don't want to have to see any more root canal patients or extraction patients than I need to. And what happens is the muscles that are responsible for closing the jaw and chewing through hard toys or eating bones or chewing up sticks or rocks, those muscles can generate more pounds per square inch than teeth can withstand. So it becomes kind of this push-pull. You want to give your pet something that's an enrichment, but at the same time, you don't want to set them up to actually break their teeth, because having a broken tooth is just as painful as it is for you or I, or if we've been fortunate not to have that happen, you know somebody who has broken a tooth and needed to go in for a root canal. So the rule of thumb that I like to use, I usually will tell people that if you want to give your pet something to chew on, if you can whack yourself in the knee with it and it hurts, it's probably too hard for them to chew on. I know a lot of other people like to use the thumbnail analogy, where if you can indent the surface of it with your thumbnail, then it's okay to chew on. But I like to go for the more, I figure if I'm going to give somebody a recommendation and want to cross them it in the pet toy aisle at Mounds or PetSmart, I'd like to see them whack themselves in the knee with whatever they're going to send home for their pet to chew on. So fantastic that you're able to, provide the T-bone steak for your dog, Treble, but I would just kind of be cautious. And probably the first thing that you would notice if your dog does end up breaking a tooth, and this happens even with dogs that aren't given necessarily bones, is that all of a sudden their chewing habits change and they don't eat their food as quickly. They're not as playful with their toys. Those are all signs of discomfort, and those should give us some reason to look and see what's going on.
Would the same be true of cats?
Cats are a little bit of a different beast.
Yeah,
so in cats, cats are very texture-driven, and cats will, even cats that we see that come in that have really painful conditions in their mouth, like we address those areas with, doing surgery and taking teeth out, and we always recommend clients feed soft food for that healing period of about 10 days afterwards. But cats will sometimes just automatically want to go back to dry food. And like I said, it becomes a texture thing. And cats are more apt to swallow their kibble necessarily than to chew it. And their preference for toys and treats and things like that is just different, because they're just not big chewers.
Treble, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Justin and Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Justin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a dog who is highly allergic to things, and she's on a hydrolyzed diet. She walks into the room. We try and keep her teeth clean and everything, but one burp and the houseplants die. It's just horrible, her breath. And I don't necessarily think it's all coming from the teeth. I think part of it is, but I'm wondering what other things can contribute to that. And also those, like, greenies, those fresh breath chews, how good are those really?
Yeah, great question. So is the hydrolyzed diet that you feed, is it a dry food, or do you canned?
It's dry food.
Okay. And how, like, what size dog do you have? Do you have a smaller breed dog or larger dog?
She's about an 80 pounder. Short and stocky, though.
Okay. Short and stocky. Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of things that can contribute to bad breath. Certainly the number one thing that we think of is something going on in the mouth. And the only way we're going to know if that's the underlying cause is to get them under anesthesia, running blood work to make sure that all their organs are working normal as they should be is a big piece of getting them ready and making sure they're safe for anesthesia. So there are some metabolic conditions that can contribute to bad breath. You know, the one that comes foremost to mind is, you know, like a ketotic patient or a patient that might have some poorly controlled blood glucose, or if they're eating solely a meat diet, those can be situations where you end up with a situation like that. So I think, you know, having just a good physical exam with your regular veterinarian and doing some standard blood work will help try to rule some of this stuff out. It's tough to know, you know, if you're not smelling that regularly, and it's just when it seems like your dog is burping up air, it probably is related to the diet. And then it kind of comes down to how intolerable is the smell versus what are the benefits of feeding hydrolyzed diets. The other piece would be, you know, greenies. So a good resource that I recommend clients go to when they're trying to pick out what diets to feed, treats or toys to use, is the Veterinary Oral Health Council's website. So it's vohc.org. And what that is those are companies that have basically presented quality research that shows that the active ingredients in their product actually clinically and statistically significantly reduce plaque or tartar buildup. So Greenies is on that list. Greenies mostly functions as a mechanical alternative to toothbrushing. So as your pet's chewing through the greenies, you know, it's not breaking down very quickly. It's helping to rub away and disrupt that plaque that's built up on teeth naturally. And it's helping to keep a good distribution of the good bacteria. So greenies is on that list. So we know that it works. Certainly it's a great tool. I sympathize with the fact that you're kind of limited to the hydrolyzed diet. You might want to ask for recommendations with your vet if there are other hydrolyzed diets you could possibly try, and maybe there's something else as an ingredient in there that is contributing to the bad breath that you might be able to remedy.
Sounds like a plan, Justin. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at your pet's health today, and particularly its teeth, with our guest today, Dr. Christopher Snyder, the UW School of Veterinary Medicine Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs and Director of UW Veterinary Care. You can join in. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Lines open for you at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We have a one-day member drive coming up on Thursday. A one-day drive works when we get an early start, so you can help us meet the goal of 1,200 donations by June 26 when we do. WPR programs, when this happens, will receive an extra $12,000 from a group of generous members. So join in now with your gift at WPR.org/donate. WPR.org/donate. Taking a look at your pet's teeth right now, later on in the show, at 12:30, we have a study of ticks in Wisconsin. There's an ongoing project, so we'll be talking about that at 12:30 today on the show. Right now, we're taking calls, and Michael in Middleton has a question for our guest, Dr. Christopher Snyder. Michael, go ahead.
Hey, hi to you both, and thanks for the show. My wife and I adopted a pair of feral kittens maybe 12 years ago. One's a calico, one's a tabby. The calico, her teeth, some of them have been removed, but some of them are being resorbed. I think that's the right verb. And then the tabby, he actually had a baby canine on one side that the permanent tooth came in over on top of. And we actually took him, he was really young, we actually took him to the UW Veterinary Orthodontic Clinic, which I didn't know such a thing existed. And that's my experience with our two adopted kittens.
All right, Michael, thanks. Comment, Christopher?
Yeah, so I think you got kind of really two good talking points that I think a lot of people have interest in. I think the first one is tooth resorption in cats. So, you know, tooth resorption in cats is a phenomenon that's really interesting because when you look at the tooth itself, the covering of tooth is enamel, and that's the same as it is in people. There's a covering of the root structure called cementum, and that's the same as it is in people as well. And what happens in cats is the enamel layer and the cementum layer don't actually touch. So they get close at the neck of the tooth. That's where it kind of is, where you can first see it in the mouth. And there's exposed dentin, and dentin makes up the meat and potatoes of the strength and the bulk of the tooth itself. For whatever reason, we're not really sure why, cats get triggered to automatically start to think that that dentin structure is foreign material, and that's why the body then starts to mobilize the cells that go in and actually start to remove it or resorb it like you've experienced. How many cats get this? Well, anywhere from 25 to 75% of cats will experience this in their life. We don't know how quickly it's going to progress when a cat does have tooth resorption start. So the best effort we can have is to identify it early and, you know, intervene. Because once it starts, a tooth starts to resorb, it will go all the way to the point where the crown or the portion of the tooth you can see in the mouth snaps and falls off, and that's going to be, you know, one of the most painful portions of the process. So we want to identify it early and jump in there. There's been a lot of research into what the underlying cause of this is, and the reality is that when there were at times people thought maybe it was something passed from cat to cat, some people thought it was created or incited by commercial diets. And what researchers found was that when you looked at the skulls of cats that were buried with the pharaohs in Egypt, or when you looked at wild cats like lions and tigers, when they're knocked down and immobilized in the wild, all of these cats have tooth resorption as well. So we don't know what the trigger is. We know that the anatomy itself of the tooth is a little bit different, predisposing it to happen. And it just ends up being a cat thing, and there's no way to prevent it. So that's point number one. The other piece that you bring up is, you know, not necessarily just a cat problem, but it's a dog problem. It's actually can be a human problem too. And that's where you have the baby tooth in the mouth and the permanent counterpart in the same location. And it was great that you got kind of referred in, your veterinarian recognized right away that this was an issue and need to be dealt with, because whenever you have a baby tooth and a permanent tooth sitting there occupying the same tooth socket, there's really very little tissue or anything that separates those two teeth. And you can imagine that then you start to pack, you know, fiber from toys or maybe the carpet. Bad bacteria start to build up in that space. Food gets trapped in that pocket. And all of that's going to contribute to the infection that causes the periodontal disease and the discomfort. So whenever we see a baby tooth and a permanent tooth occupying that same socket, we always recommend that baby tooth come out as soon as we can safely remove it, because we don't want to jeopardize having to remove the adult tooth and the baby tooth at the same time. So it sounds like probably that's what you were referred into. And we do on our dentistry and oral surgery service, we do some orthodontics but a lion's share of what we deal with are bad periodontal disease, oral tumors, jaw fractures, tooth resorption, things like that.
Hmm. Interesting. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. Michelle in Appleton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Michelle.
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two small dogs, which I understand are very prone to dental issues. One is a Shih Tzu and one is a Shih Tzu mix. And we started using one of these dental powders in their dry kibble in order to try and keep their teeth a little healthier than they have been. And I was just wondering what the doctor's opinion is on those products.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. That's a great question. I think there's so much marketing and so many products that are out there that claim to have benefits to our pet's oral health. So, it probably has been explained to you by your veterinarian. You know, Shih Tzus are one of those breeds where their upper jaw and lower jaw don't line up. And that's kind of the breed normal. Actually, my first dog was a Shih Tzu. She was fantastic. But whenever the jaws are misaligned, we start to lose the normal self-cleaning that chewing can do. So those self-cleaning mechanisms kind of go away. When you lose the self-cleaning, then we start to look at what are our other options to help clean and disrupt that plaque layer that's there. The dental powders, the main concern with those or any of the topical things, including water additives or oral rinses, is that they don't actually get below the gum line where those bad bacteria are building up. So, I always would suggest that, people look at what's on that website of the proven, from a research perspective, list of products. And, if you always think that, the biggest help that we have for ourselves to maintain a good oral health is the toothbrushing. And it's really just it's not even the toothpaste that helps keep our mouths clean. And it's not the toothpaste in our veterinary patients either. It's the bristles reaching below the gum line to do the work that they need to. So I can't really comment specifically on how much the powder is probably helping. But my go-tos tend to be if brushing is not part of the equation or an option. The next thing I look at is recommending dental diets, just because we have to feed our pets twice a day or at least every day.
Yeah. And again, that organization website is V as in Victor, VOHC.org. And I've got, you're nodding. I've got it right. All right, yeah. Michelle, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Lori, who's traveling through Wisconsin, what's on your mind?
Good morning. I have a success story that I just wanted to share. About 9 years ago, I adopted a special needs puppy. He was born with a very severe heart defect. They didn't expect him to survive a year, but the vet told me one thing that I could do to prolong his life was to make sure that I kept his teeth brushed. So I trained him to use a Sonicare toothbrush, and I used that Sonicare toothbrush on him once a day, and he kind of actually falls asleep now while I use the Sonicare toothbrush on him. I use it for the 2 full minutes, and 9 years later, he's still with us. He can't go under anesthesia for the dental, so we couldn't even put him under to get him neutered, so we were really dependent on brushing his teeth. And I thought, if the Sonicare works for me, gotta work for him. So it's our little success story. And now I'm training our second dachshund puppy for it.
Somebody's going to say, how in the blazes did you train your puppy?
Oh, that takes a lot of patience. And what you do is you train them to touch their nose to a stick. You touch their nose to a stick, they get a treat. Touch the nose to a stick, they get a treat. Then you train them to allow it in their mouth. So you allow, that's the normal toothbrushing thing. And then later on, you turn the thing on and get them to touch their nose to it while it's buzzing. And gradually over time, you get them to hold it longer and hold it longer. And eventually they allow it in their mouth. And it just becomes a part of their normal day. And it takes a lot of patience, but it takes usually about, I'm still working with with our dachshund puppy. It's been about 3 months I've been working with her on it. And she allows me to brush her teeth, but I can't get the 2 full minutes in. So it's a work in progress.
Well, I'm glad you explained that. Dr. Snyder, comment?
Yeah, thanks, Lori. That's a fantastic success story that you have. Congratulations on that. I think that you're probably, spot on, your veterinarian's spot on, that keeping your pet's mouth clean has really contributed to not only the longevity of your pet's life, but also the comfort of your pet's mouth. I do think it's important for listeners also to recognize that, using a Sonicare, a couple thoughts. Number one, a mechanical toothbrush like that, is just as effective as a manual toothbrush. And you're going to find that there are some pets that just don't like the vibrating action of it, or they don't like the sound of the mechanical toothbrush. So, people shouldn't be discouraged if they themselves use a mechanical toothbrush and their pet won't tolerate it. I think you did everything right. You get them used to the toothbrush first, then you acclimate them to the sound and the feel of it. But I think the important piece is, and I have encountered some clients that have a different opinion than I do. And my opinion is that you have to make sure that you use a different toothbrush head for your pet than you do for yourself. I have seen people who have felt that, they love their pet and that, their pet gives them kisses, whatever you want to call it. But in reality, the bacteria in a dog or cat's mouth is different than the bacteria in a person's mouth. And while I'm sure that you use a different toothbrush head for your pets than you do for yourself, I do want to make sure that our listening audience is aware that, yeah, you really should, unless you're drinking out of the same water bowl as the dog or the cat, then you should have your own toothbrushes.
Okay. Lori, thanks a lot. This is a great story and a great success story. I appreciate it very much. Dawn in Wausau, we'll go to you now. Hi, Dawn.
Yes, thanks. So my question is regarding dental under anesthesia. I have an American short hair who's about 10 years old, 8 pounds, no pre-existing conditions, had all the blood work prior to the procedure. And he ended up having walking around in sort of an agitated sort of stupor. And we finally took him to the vet, and they actually administered a reversal agent, which, most people probably know as the brand name Narcan. And what I'm concerned about is I would like to continue to, make sure that his dental health is as ideal as possible. But this was a very, very adverse experience for both him and us. And so I'd like to find out, what are the possible reasons that this, could have happened, such as maybe he metabolized anesthesia differently. So I'd like to find out your thoughts on that.
Sure. So just so I'm kind of following you correctly, so your cat, we're talking about an American short hair, like a brachycephalic cat, is that correct?
American short hair, yep.
So we use a variety of different medications when it comes to general anesthesia. And, those medications, by using little bits of this and little bits of that, you don't have to use high doses of any one medication. And those are where, when we use high doses, that's where we see a lot of the side effects. So, Narcan is a reversal agent for the opioid or the morphine family of drugs. There's a handful of them that we use regularly in veterinary medicine. The reversal agent usually works pretty quickly. It doesn't necessarily hang on long enough to the specific receptors for the opioid or that class of drug to wear off. But, I would first look at, giving that, if your veterinarian prescribed you the Narcan and they were able to do the reversal, then, that goes in the medical record. So for future anesthetic treatments, they're going to be able to tweak the doses, maybe choose different drugs, and that's going to help try to prevent that issue from coming up again next time. So, every patient's going to be a little bit different when it comes to their sensitivity to drugs, just like, Advil works well for me and Tylenol might work better for Larry. And, you know, it just keeping that medical record up to date. And if you have to go see another veterinarian in the event that you can't have your records transferred over, you know, just kind of recounting that this was your experience, and that can help us pick drugs that don't have the same types of side effects.
Yeah. Don, thank you very much for calling. And let's take a call from Bob in Madison. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I found a cat, and I had never had one before. My friend suggested that I feed him only dry food, and I keep it out all the time. And he seems to be healthy. It's been 5 years now. I wonder if that's hurting his teeth by always having to chew that. And I've tried wet food, and he won't eat it.
Yeah, good question. So, you know, if anything, you know, cats, you know, they're texture driven. They tend to really swallow their kibble rather than chew it up. You know, you're not doing anything harmful with regard to maintaining a good, happy, healthy mouth for your cat. So, you know, I would keep on, you know, moving along with the dry food. We typically will recommend that for cats and dogs to help reduce that tartar buildup or that plaque accumulation. So, you know, as long as your cat's otherwise healthy, no issues with vomiting or diarrhea or issues with the litter box, those would all be things that you'd talk to your vet about, then, you know, you're probably helping your cat more than anything by using the dry food over the wet. So, good choice.
There you go, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Christopher Snyder, our guest today from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. It's great to have him with us. And you can join in as well. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk at WPR.org. If you call, we'll get you on pretty quickly. I have some open lines. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about the book Ballistic, The New Science of Injury-Free Athletic Performance. You'll hear why incorporating more jumping into your workouts might be a great way to prevent injury. And we'll also talk about protecting our Wisconsin coasts and organic farming as well. So lots going on tomorrow. Right now, we're taking a look at your pet's teeth with Dr. Christopher Snyder of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Mary in Minocqua, thank you for joining in. What's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to mention that sticks are not good toys for dogs or to chew on because the splinters can embed in their gums and cause infection. That happened to my dog, and it was so bad his eye was bulging out, and he had to have surgery. And his vet told me that that's actually pretty common.
Wow, Dr. Snyder?
Yeah, it's, I think the common part is that dogs like to chew on sticks. I think, you know, it's a natural soothing mechanism that a lot of dogs are going to gravitate towards. You know, in choosing sticks, you know, the big downside to that's those chewing on sticks is those splinters or those pieces of bark or even the wood itself that can break off. You know, it is organic material, and, you know, we do have some situations where, you know, those splinters can get embedded in places, and they take some time, but they'll break down and fall out. And then there are other situations, kind of like you had experience with your dog, where a bigger piece gets lodged in a place where, you know, the body's trying to fight it off, and it generates a source of infection and inflammation. And then you have situations where, yeah, surgically, we have to go in and remove them. Fortunately, I think a lot of people are more aware of that nowadays, and they try to pick more appropriate chew objects for their pet. I myself have been unlucky in that we adopted a golden retriever, and within the first year of his life, he decided he was going to eat two landscaping stones. So had to go in, have surgery, have them removed. Not really sure what really drives that in our veterinary patients. Usually I think it's taste or smell. But yeah, they can be indiscriminate eaters or chew on things. And yep, having that lodged in places it shouldn't be, that can happen.
Yeah. I was thinking back, this is about 25 years ago. I was at my dentist's office, and you could see outside a fenced-in area where his St. Bernard was acting strangely, and he said, I'm in the chair, and he said, let's go out and take a look. So I got out of the chair, And he, we went out to the dog. He said, I'll hold its mouth open and you look inside. So I looked inside and there was a, he had bitten down on a stick and it was crosswise in his mouth. So he went back into the office, got his pliers that he uses for pulling teeth, and I held the dog's mouth open while he pulled out the stick. That was quite an experience.
Yeah. that happens. And, you know, when we see those patients come in, it's frequent that they're going to come in through, like, the emergency service for not acting right, or sometimes they'll have weird head movements, yeah, or they'll be doing things with their neck or their tongue. You know, it's really rewarding to be able to find that it's something that can be solved that easily as removing it. And, yeah, why they ultimately are chewing on it in the first place is still a mystery.
Neil in Winona, Minnesota, we'll go to you. Hi, Neil.
Hi. Hello. First of all, I got to apologize. I just came across your show here on the radio, and I heard you talking about pet health. I didn't realize until after I called it was mostly talking about their teeth health, I guess. But we've got a couple of Cocker Spaniels, females, a 4- and 5-year-old. And I'm going to try and connect this to teeth somehow, but they're constantly licking and scratching and chewing on their paws, and we're at our wit's end trying to, you know, we've tried a bunch of different things from Cytopoint to probiotics and different allergy medicines, and just kind of we're trying to get to the bottom of that, and I guess we're connected to teeth is, would that have anything to do in the long run, all that licking and chewing and nibbling on their feet, I guess, with their teeth?
Yeah, thanks, Neil. That's a great question. You know, I think, you know, ultimately, kind of like you're recognizing is, you know, this is probably an underlying allergy, which is the concern. You know, there's a lot of things that can set off allergies, anything from different laundry detergents that we use all the way to the food and diet that they're on. You know, it sounds like you've had a pretty thorough workup with your veterinarian. And ultimately, it kind of comes down to what do we need to do to help keep our pets as comfortable as possible. So I think probably continuing to explore what those options are. As far as their dental health goes, and making a connection, you know, probably not as much as the chewing on paws and scratching and chewing at certain parts of their body, because that's very allergy driven. But sometimes what people will report is, especially with small breed dogs when they come in, sometimes they'll be referred in to see us because they're licking in the air. Like they're just kind of doing this tongue thrusting movement where they're not licking anything in particular, but they're doing this repetitive motion and, you know, kind of unsure what the underlying cause is. I think that in my experience is that, you know, when we stub our toe, oh no, I'm making a stretch here. I'm going from one end of the body to the other. But when you stub your toe, the inclination after maybe you shout a few choice words is to then go and rub it. And that doesn't make a lot of sense, right? Like we just hurt our toe, it's painful. But our reaction is to go and rub it. And it's the rubbing of the of your toe after you stub it that overwhelms the nerve endings and actually makes the sense of pain go away. So in some patients, like I said, when they come in and they don't have the kind of the allergy specific piece of their licking habits and things like that, it's not unusual that I'll get them under anesthesia and I'll find that their front teeth, their incisor teeth, tend to have periodontal disease or a source of pain. And it's that licking of the air or that tongue thrusting movement that they're, I think, doing the same thing that we do with rubbing our toe. Their teeth hurt, and that by kind of overstimulating those loose and painful teeth, it helps make the pain go away. So, you know, I would say continue to work with your veterinarian. You know, you can ask for, you know, other opinions for additional workup as far as dermatology goes. The good news is that there's very few allergic conditions that affect parts of the body that also have clinical signs in their mouth as well. So
there you go, Neil.
A completely separate problem.
Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Vivian in Green Bay. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. I have some questions about frequent anesthesia because our pets have to be anesthetized for dentals. And the older pets, I have a 14-year-old dog that is still getting dentals, So any cautions, recommendations?
Okay.
Yeah, good question, Vivian. You know, we get that a lot here with a dentistry-only practice. And I'd say a couple things. I'd say, number one, your concern is not unusual. You know, we hear that quite a bit. Probably of our caseload here at the university, probably about a quarter to a third of the cases that we see, they're not really even coming to see me as a veterinary dentist. They're coming in because there are anesthetic concerns and they want an anesthesiologist's kind of oversight, drug selection, those pieces. So I would say that, you know, a good contributor, the fact that your dog has lived to be 14 years old, probably has been the fact that you've been staying ahead of making sure that your dog's mouth is clean. And I would share another cautionary tale too with the audience, and that is, not so much in the Midwest, but on the two coasts, the idea of anesthesia-free dentistry is starting to become really popular. Actually, it's been really popular for probably about 10 to 15 years. And what that is and what that looks like is, usually there's people who travel around, they come into the clinic certain days of the week, and they, you know, wrap a warm towel around a dog, then a dark room, and they whisper sweet nothings in the dog's ear. And then they get in there with dental tools and they clean off the tartar or the calculus that you see on the crowns of the teeth. And that's really concerning from the veterinary dental community, because it's kind of like buying a used car, but not turning the key to make sure that what's under the hood actually works. So by just cleaning the crowns of the teeth, you're not getting to where the underlying bacteria is, where the infection is building up, and you get this false sense of security that the teeth are actually being cleaned effectively, and they're really, unfortunately,
not.
It doesn't work that way. Mm. So, you know, I think, you know, always do the pre-anesthetic blood work, you know, work with your veterinarian, make sure your pet's safe for general anesthesia. And again, I think that a lot of credit to the fact that your dog's lived to be 14 has been that you've been on top of that, keeping the mouth healthy. So good on you.
Yeah. Thank you, Vivian. Elizabeth wonders, she says her husband insists on allowing her dog to lick the empty dish of ice cream on an empty plate. How does human food affect our dog's health?
Yeah, so, you know, our dogs and cats, for the most part, you know, they don't have iron stomachs like we do. You know, we want Italian one night, we want Chinese food another night, maybe we want steak and potatoes the next. Yeah, they're a lot more prone to have upset of their stomach and have that, you know, show up as issues with vomiting or diarrhea, or even worse, pancreatitis. And that's why, you know, keeping dogs and cats, which are creatures of habit, kind of isolated to, you know, just their dog food is really, or cat food is important. A big piece that I think is important to remember is that there are ingredients in human food that are safe for us that are not safe for dogs especially. And that the one that comes to mind that we see most frequently is called xylitol. And xylitol is a sugar replacer. Tastes nice and sweet, but our body can't do anything with it, which is why it doesn't have any calories. You can get xylitol-based sweeteners for baking. There's probably xylitol-based sweets and desserts and things like that are going to be marketed as reduced calorie and, you know, low or no sugar. And, you know, ultimately the body, our dog friends, their body sees xylitol, they get really excited and think there's a lot of sugar that needs to be broken down and metabolized. And then there's a huge onset of insulin release. And then they end up having, they can be in a real bad place with toxicity from that. So, are a little treats good every now and again? Yes. Should you look for the veterinary or the animal-specific treats and desserts? That's always going to be the safest way to go.
And on that note, Dr. Snyder, thank you so much for being with us. I hope you'll come back and do this again. I really appreciate your help.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Larry.
Dr. Christopher Snyder is the UW School of Veterinary Medicine's Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs and Director of UW Veterinary Care. Great to have him with us, and we'll get him back and do it again. Coming up, we're going to take a look at pet insurance for your animal. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking about pet care on the show today. And next, we're taking a look at pet insurance with our guest, Dr. Ricky Walther. He is the chief medical officer at Policy Advisor. It's an online pet insurance marketplace, and it's, I like the name, Policy is P-A-W-L-I-C-Y, Policy Advisor. Online pet insurance marketplace. So as we talk pet insurance, I hope you'll join in. What do you think about it? Let us know how it's helped your pet, maybe saved your wallet. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Ricky Walther, thank you for joining in today. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Tell us a bit more about Policy Advisor and the work you do there.
Yeah, so Policy Advisor is a pet insurance marketplace. So we operate in a way as a broker across all 50 states where we help pet owners find the right policy for their individual pet, given the age, breed, and where they live. So we help them compare and contrast different options and look through all kind of the fine print of different pet insurance policies so that they can make sure that the policy that they choose ultimately is the best fit for their unique pet. And we partner with veterinarians and other members of the pet health and industry to help kind of promote the idea of pet insurance and how it can be a helpful tool for pet owners.
How does pet insurance work?
That's a great question. So pet insurance works kind of like other lines of insurance. So you can think about it somewhat similarly to car insurance or maybe how your home insurance policy works. It's really a way to mitigate risk and kind of budget for care by knowing that you're insured for accidents and illnesses that could come up in your pet's life. So it's a little bit of a misunderstanding sometimes that it operates similar to the way that human health insurance does. It's not typically it doesn't typically function that way. It's more for accident and illness insurance, where basically you're paying a premium on a monthly or annual basis in order to have a certain level of coverage after a deductible towards medical expenses incurred in that year. There are aspects of what we call wellness add-ons to pet insurance that operate a little bit more similarly to the way that human health insurance works, where they'll help cover certain amounts towards vaccines, potentially spay or neuter, or other annual type visits and behaviors within the veterinary hospital. But those are typically kind of bought together as two separate products through a pet insurance company.
So you can get different types of, you can get accident only plans, as I understand it, or you can get the combination accident and illness plans.
That's correct. Yeah. So you can insure basically just accidents, right? So things like a pet falling and breaking its leg or something of that nature would be considered an accident. Or what I would say is probably most common are accident and illness policies, right? So you're insuring against your healthy pet at the time of insurance, getting some kind of disease later on, right? Say a pet, you know, a healthy pet ends up getting something like a UTI or diabetes or an allergic skin disease after they're insured, then that kind of triggers the policy and you can submit receipts to be reimbursed. Two really important things to keep in mind about pet insurance is that pre-existing conditions are not covered. So at the time that you insure your pet, there's typically a waiting period, most commonly a couple of weeks, in which case any diseases that happen in that time will be considered pre-existing. But once that waiting period ends, then everything that's not pre-existing will be eligible for that kind of level of coverage, depending on the reimbursement percentage you choose. The other thing that's really important to keep in mind about pet insurance is that it is one of those things that you will get reimbursed for. So you, it doesn't often, there's minus a few kind of edge cases, it doesn't often pay your veterinarian directly. You often will pay your bill and then submit receipts to the insurance provider to be reimbursed at a later time.
So
typically a couple of weeks.
Yeah. And so it's important to have those receipts.
That's correct. Yep. You want to make sure that you're keeping invoices and receipts and working, making sure that your veterinarian knows that you have insurance so that they can help to get you the proper paperwork that you need at the end of your visit. The good news is the majority of veterinary hospitals keep really good records of receipts and things of that nature. So your veterinarian can always help you out if you potentially misplace a receipt or two.
There's a plan that involves accident illness plans with wellness. And I'm wondering about that. What's the maybe explain that a little bit.
Yeah. So when we combined an accident and illness policy with a wellness add-on through most pet insurance providers, what that means is that wellness piece is going to be a certain amount of money or a percentage reimbursement towards certain pre-agreed upon services, right? So when you purchase that wellness policy, it's going to say that it gives you X amount of money towards vaccinations, potentially X amount of money towards a heartworm prevention or a flea and tick prevention. It may have an amount that they give you back towards spay or neuter procedures. And some even have some like dental cleaning or x-ray components that you can, for certain services, you're reimbursed a certain amount. And that's kind of what I like to tell people, it's kind of a separate product than the actual accident and illness policy that operates more like insurance, but you buy them often at the same time for the same pet.
Yeah, we just finished spending an hour talking about dental, and so that might be something that some people would think about considering for insurance.
Yeah, that's correct. Dental disease is actually one of those things that I think is a really common driver for people to look into pet insurance. I'm sure what you guys covered probably explained that dental procedures can be costly, but they're super important for pet health. And so what's really interesting about pet insurance is that, you know, depending on whether or not that dental is being done for medical reasons, right? Infected teeth or a tooth that has an abscess and needs to be removed. Often those will actually trigger that accident and illness policy to pay out. And then certain wellness policies also have aspects that cover routine dental cleanings or something of that nature. So they can be really synergistic. And that's actually partially why we created Policies Marketplace, is so that people can dive into the details. As you can see, it's really complicated. And so an individual pet's use case really needs kind of tailored and customized recommendations.
And how do people find Policy Advisor? I suppose just type in and it's going to pop up.
So a couple of different ways. So Policy Advisor's website is PAWLICY.com. And we have a full website experience where users can go through and find the right policy for their individual pet on their own and kind of asynchronously in just a couple of minutes. But we also have licensed insurance agents that can help owners who want, you know, a little bit more guidance through the process and really making sure that they're picking the right policy for their pet. And in that case, you can call 1-866-POLICY, so PAWLICY. That number will take you to our licensed agents who can help you kind of navigate the options, or maybe even if you're on our website and you have a question about something that we've called out as different between two policies, they're the best people to be able to help you.
Roughly what percentage of pet owners have their pets insured?
That's a great question. So the 2023 data on this, with basically looking at the full 2023 calendar year, showed that we're up to about 3.92% of pets insured. The majority of those are dogs. So dogs actually in the US, we're up to about 5.46%. And cats is just over 2% right now. So that ends up being a growth rate in pet insurance that we've seen pretty consistently of about 20% year over year since 2020. So it's definitely growing and becoming more popular, but still pretty pretty small in terms of number of total insured pets.
I'm wondering why. more people haven't gotten involved? Is it just a knowledge thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that the reason why pet insurance has been slow in its uptake in the United States is for a couple of different reasons. One, I do think is awareness. I think that a lot of pet owners still don't know that pet insurance exists, or maybe are not being talked to about it at, say, the veterinary hospital. There's a lot of effort, and we work really closely with the veterinary community to help with that. So giving veterinary teams resources to be able to have this conversation more proactively in the clinic when people are thinking about their pet's health. So I think that's one major reason. The other, I think, is because of the fact that these policies are evolving over time. And the initial, but it's slow. So I would say the innovation in the space is definitely picking up. And so people are looking for policies that meet them where they are, right, and cover the things they want covered for their pets. And we're starting to see more and more providers starting to innovate on what those different types of coverage are. We're now up to about 30 different carriers in the United States, and that's a rapid increase in, I would say, probably the last 10 years. So we're starting to see a lot more traction and a lot more options, which I hope will help increase the percent of pets insured. We're also seeing pet insurance start to show up as employee benefits. And so just in the last probably 10 years, we've started to see companies offer discounts for different pet insurance providers through their employee benefits package, which I do think will help to continue to increase the uptake in this space. But it's really important to make sure you compare what your employer offers to all the other options out there to make sure it's still truly the best fit and the best price for your pet.
In your mind, why is pet insurance important?
That's a great question. So I, as a doctor and as a small animal veterinarian, you know, I think costs in veterinary medicine and in medical professions in general have increased quite a bit, especially in the last few years. And I think it's starting to get to a place where, you know, the average pet owner is having a difficult time affording the care that they want to provide for their pets. And so I think that pet insurance is a really great solution for people to consider as a tool in your toolbox, basically, to help afford the care you want to provide for your pet. The reality is, I think all of us would like to put money aside every month for the care of our pets in a savings account and be diligent about that. And just like we probably would love to do that for our car and everything else. But we know that insurance provides value in that scenario because it's something you pay for consistently, and it gives you that peace of mind that you're going to be able to afford a bill when something bad happens. And I think that's the reason why I think pet insurance is such an important piece of owning a pet and something that most people should at least look into whether or not they can afford it, because it allows for budgeting for those emergency conditions or emergency illnesses or things that you're not expecting, where you still can say yes to the care that your veterinary team is recommending without having to feel as much of that financial strain. Now, I'm not going to say that pet insurance is the best fit for every single person. Sometimes pet insurance is too expensive for certain individuals, or may not cover what they're looking for, or they have an older pet with lots of pre-existing conditions where pet insurance may not make sense. But I do think that every pet owner should at least evaluate their options on pet insurance and see whether or not it's a good way for them to budget for care. I also tell owners, though, we shouldn't expect pet insurance to try to save us money, because it really is insurance, right? We are paying to insure risk of something bad happening in the future. If those bad things don't happen, pet insurance likely will cost more than not having it for a pet. But it's when those cases that do happen where there is big payouts needed to help your pet's medical care, that's when pet insurance can really save people money and allow them to say yes to the care they want to provide.
Yeah, I can think of situations from personal experience or friends' experiences where suddenly you're faced with a $5,000 emergency kind of situation. It's going to cost $5,000 for the pet, and that is a tough thing if you don't have any insurance to suddenly have to make some hard decisions on.
And that's correct. I think that the challenge is, right, those $5,000 veterinary bills are becoming more common, right? Emergency care is expensive. Medical care in general is going up. And so it's really not that unrealistic to think that in your pet's lifetime, something like that could happen. They could eat something that they're not supposed to and end up in the emergency room, or, you know, they could develop a condition that requires chronic care for the whole life of the pet and costs a couple hundred dollars a month. Both of those situations can be really challenging for pet owners to afford if they weren't planning on it. And so that's where I think pet insurance is most useful, is in young and healthy pets. Purchasing a pet insurance policy and planning to keep it for the lifetime of the pet in order to really help prevent those situations where you do have to make a decision you're not looking to make as ideal for your pet because of finances in the moment.
You know, we have veterinarians on the program from time to time, usually about once a month at least, we'll on the show, and they'll often will talk about breeds. And a veterinarian might say, well, this breed has known to have this certain kind of condition. And I'm wondering, how much does a pet's breed matter when it comes to insurance?
Yeah, so thank you for that question. I think, you know, breed is one of the major factors that affects pet insurance, and it affects it in a couple of different ways. Breed affects the price, right? So breeds that are known to be high risk for a lot of medical conditions are sometimes more expensive to insure. What's really interesting, though, is that every carrier is going to treat that differently and decide on a pricing structure differently. That's partially why Policy Advisor exists as a comparison tool, is because we then tailor the recommendation that we give you to the breed of pet that you have, the age of that pet, and where it lives, because all of those things affect the price. The other thing that's really important to keep in mind about pet insurance is that it is an annual policy. So it does have the ability or potential to go up in price year over year. One of the things that we do at Policy Advisor is assign these policies lifetime value scores so that we can help owners understand what those rate increases could be year over year, so that they pick a plan that they can pay for that particular breed and keep that policy for the lifetime of the pet.
That's a good service. I mean, if you can have those numbers in front of you.
Exactly. That's the thing, is it's all about, I think the other thing that with pet insurance that we need to do better as, I think, as an entire industry, is really helping with transparency, right? Pet owners want to know what they're getting for the money that they're spending on insurance. And they want to know what that could possibly cost in the future. And can they afford it, right? Pet insurance doesn't do anybody any good if you can afford it in year one, but when the price goes up in year two, you cancel it before you used it. That's not helping you provide the best care for your pet. And so at Policy Advisor, we believe in transparency and trying to really promote all those details to the surface so that owners can make an informed decision.
Is there a standard? No, there isn't a standard cost, but I mean, typically, what's a range of costs for pet insurance?
Yeah. So in preparation for this, I pulled some data from the North American Pet Health Insurance Association's most recent report. And they reported in 2024 that the average price for a dog's accident and illness policy is around $62 a month. So that's an average across all states, right? So certain states are going to be cheaper than others because vet care in those states is cheaper than other states. And so you can think about that as a national average, kind of assume where your state is in comparison to that national average and average cost of living, and that'll give you an idea there. For cats, that accident and illness policy is closer to $32 a month. So you can see for cats, pet insurance is actually a lot less expensive. Cats, we know, tend to go to the vet less often, and their medical conditions are a little bit harder sometimes. They're sneaky. They come up on us without us knowing. Cats are extremely good at hiding conditions. So the insurance can be really helpful for cats as well, because you may not know that your pet is sick, right? But by the time they are really sick, they often need extensive care. But because they go a little bit less frequently and their risk factors are different, the cost is definitely substantially less for cats in general.
Jeff in Superior has something for us. Jeff, hi.
Hello. You may hear my dogs alerting you all that the mailman is walking in front of my house right now. I wanted to let people know about or remind people that there's also rebates available for a lot of medication. And so I've used that. At one point, one of my dogs is on a couple different medications at the same time. And ironically, between the pet insurance reimbursement and also the rebates, there was a short period where I was actually making money by keeping my dog healthy. I was getting paid back more than what it was costing.
Oh, my goodness. That Ricky, Dr. Walter, comment?
Yeah, so I think that that's a really great point, right? Around there's when I think about ways to pay for care, the biggest thing that I tell owners is that we want to look into all kinds of different solutions, right? So pet insurance is a great solution, but there's also all kinds of other opportunities and incentives to keep in mind. Rebates are a great way to get money back on medication. There's also other ways too to help budget for care in general. There are certain credit cards that can be used for pet care, right? So financing solutions that can help you pay your bill until the time of reimbursement for insurance. A lot of people don't know that, right? So you can put a bill on one of these credit card solutions if you apply for it, and then you can pay it off with your reimbursement. So that's also kind of an opportunity to not go out of pocket. And the other thing too is that a lot of veterinary clinics offer wellness programs. So sometimes it's rebates, but other times it's discounts that are offered with your own veterinarian. The cool thing that I like to tell owners is if your veterinarian offers one of those wellness plans, it doesn't mean insurance is not helpful for your pet. Insurance can sometimes cover the things that that wellness plan does not, right? Maybe you don't need the wellness add-on we talked earlier about, Larry, where like it's those other kind of out-of-pocket expenses, but your vet clinic can actually have a program like that in certain hospitals that can help really complement insurance well. So I think it's a multifactorial approach on like, how can we help afford care so that we can treat our pets like family members, like so many of us feel they are, and give them the care that they need.
So are there pre-existing, what would be an example of pre-existing conditions? What are some things that maybe won't be covered?
Yeah, so I think that that's a great question. So you can think about it as basically anything that your pet was diagnosed with prior to you applying for insurance and having that waiting period complete is going to be considered pre-existing. So some examples of that would be your pet has an allergic skin disease on its record, right? So say you have a two-year-old dog. When that dog was a year old, it went into the vet and was treated for an ear infection and an infection on the skin, potentially due to allergies. That pet is going to be marked by most insurance companies as basically an allergic pet or having allergic skin disease and an ear infection on record. What that means is that every carrier is going to treat that differently. Certain carriers will have what we call extended waiting periods, where then they waive certain conditions or allow for them to be covered again in the future. And others won't cover anything related to allergic skin disease from there on, but will cover that pet eating a sock, right? And needing surgery to have it removed. I actually, as a veterinarian, feel it's really, really important, even for pets with chronic illness, like allergic skin disease, to consider pet insurance. Because I saw firsthand my clients that had to come out of pocket for chronic skin disease. They're spending a lot of money every single month on these medical conditions. And then if they do have a major surgery or another major incident, that's depleted a lot of their savings or what they budget for their pet. So saving a little bit extra every month to pay for your insurance policy, even if you know it's not going to cover the thing you're paying every month for, still could be helpful for that emergency condition down the road.
Dr. Walther, tell us again how we get in touch with a policy advisor.
Yeah, so two different ways. Easiest would be going to our website and going through our comparison tool to look at different options yourself. That is pawlicy.com, or calling our number to speak to one of our licensed insurance agents at 1-866-PAWLICY. Both of those ways will get you to our service. Policy Advisor is completely free for pet owners to use. So there's no fee that you pay for helping us or having us help you find your pet the right policy. And I hope that everybody can get some value out of what we've created and compare their options and see if pet insurance is the right fit for them.
We'll get you back, Dr. Walther. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I look forward to another visit. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Dr. Ricky Walther, Chief Medical Officer at Policy Advisor. It was great to have him with us. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about your pet and ticks, and you'll hear how Wisconsin researchers are keeping track of ticks in our state. I'm Larry Mueller. Pet parents know that ticks are no joke. They can upset your dog or your cat. They also give some nasty diseases. Good thing that we have researchers here at Wisconsin, at the University of Wisconsin, who are keeping an eye on tick populations. And one of the people involved with that is Lyric Bartholomew. She is our guest, and she's a UW-Madison professor in the School of Veterinary Medicine. She studies mosquitoes and ticks and the infectious disease agents that they transmit, and is one of the directors of the Midwest Center for Excellence Vector-Borne Disease. We'll probably talk with her about that a little bit, too, as we move along today. But let us know your questions about tick-borne illnesses in your pet. Or maybe tell us how many ticks you've noticed in your area this spring. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Professor Lyric Bartholomew, thank you for joining us.
Oh, Larry, I'm so delighted to be here. I'm a big fan.
Well, let's talk about the tick population. How's it looking in Wisconsin this year?
Well, it's just as obnoxious as usual, Larry. we're seeing pretty normal numbers of ticks in most of the places where our colleagues at the Department of Health Services regularly go and check for ticks.
Now, you helped develop a tick app that people can download on their smartphones for free. And I went and looked at it. It's pretty cool. How's it used?
Yeah, the tick app is, I hope, mutually beneficial. We're using that as a research tool to try and understand when and where people come in contact with ticks. And people can use it, tell us what they're doing when they come in contact with a tick, and even send us a picture of the tick so that we can identify it and send them back word of which tick they've been exposed to or encountered.
And we have a link to the app on our website. So how are you using the information?
Yeah, we've gotten some really interesting information over the years. We started the tick app back in 2018, and we did a comparison to try and understand how people in the Midwest compare to people in the Northeast in terms of tick interactions, and learned some really interesting things there. Not surprisingly, Larry, we saw that people in Wisconsin tend to be really outdoorsy and have lots of chances to come in contact with ticks. We saw that people in Wisconsin also oftentimes mow their own yards, which is different from what we saw in with folks in New Jersey and New York. And we found out that people are encountering ticks more often in their backyards than we had previously appreciated. I think we kind of used to have this idea that people came in contact with the ticks, that at least the ones that transmit the bacteria that cause Lyme disease. We thought, well, you find those ticks when you go up north to your cabin or you go vacation elsewhere. But with the tick app, we started to see that more people were reporting ticks coming into contact with those ticks right in their backyards. And that really helped us launch some research projects where we're trying to understand how to better control ticks in people's yards.
Yes, that's interesting, too, because I've always heard that, you know, the story always was, well, your lawn is, the grass is short, you're not going to have tick issues.
Right. So I think that that can be true, especially in the center of your yard and if your yard gets lots of sunshine. But if your yard is right up against a wooded area and there's plenty of sort of leaf litter and underbrush around your green grass, There are places where we find ticks kind of trickling into even the mowed yard.
Yeah. I had one in my yard, I don't know, a few weeks back. Something on my neck, and I pulled it off, and well, here's a tick. Mm-hmm. Well, it hadn't attached.
Oh, good. Yeah, so that's what we're trying to do with the tick app, too, is encourage people to, you know, really be alert to these things. The tick app will send you messages to remind you to check for ticks and do the kinds of things that can protect you from coming in contact with them, and then make sure they're not on your body once you come inside.
And they're normally active. Ticks are normally active across a broad range of months here in our state, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. So we see tick activity, you know, when the temperatures are right, we can see different life stages of ticks. And so we might see in the very early spring some adult ticks. These are the ticks that transmit Lyme disease. We might see adult ticks early in the spring. We usually see the nymph stage of ticks right around now. And we'll see the baby ticks, larval ticks, coming up too. And then in the fall, we might see adult ticks again. So it's this very long-lived life cycle. And in Wisconsin, we kind of have the full onslaught of them.
Gary in Spring Valley has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
Hey, I have a question. I spend a great deal of time in the woods constantly. I've got 25 acres of woods that I'm constantly working in, and we live in the country. I cut my own grass and stuff like that. But yet I don't have any trouble with ticks. My wife can go out for a walk with me, and she'll come back in and have two or three ticks on her, and I don't get any.
Isn't that amazing?
And I, you know, I've talked to other people who, you know, have the same kind of experience that I do. But I'm just wondering if is there any research being done on what might chemically be different about me that and others that don't ticks that maybe could be useful. I don't know, if I take a supplement or a medication of some kind or whatever that might make me less attractive to ticks, but mm-hmm. they don't seem to land on me ever. Once in maybe two or three years, I'll find one crawling on me, but never attached.
Well, Gary, I'd say you're a really lucky man, and I hope it won't offend you if I say that perhaps you're a bit repellent. I know that I am, too. I just don't seem to get very many ticks on me, but I have family members, just like you've said with your wife, who are just magnets. And so we could walk side by side in the woods and they'd come in loaded with ticks and I wouldn't have any on me. I think what we're understanding from other bloodsuckers, research on things like mosquitoes, is that there are all kinds of things that attract these bloodsuckers to us. That's, you know, things like CO2 and lactic acid that are coming off of our bodies. But probably there's also something about just all the bacteria on our skin that also alert these things to our presence or push them away from us. So I think it's brilliant to imagine that would be something that could be researched and be really informative.
Yeah. But
we're not doing that right now.
Okay. Well, what are the main diseases? There are several diseases, are there not, that ticks can
transmit? There really are. So we have really two main ticks that people and pets would encounter in the state of Wisconsin. Those are what we call the deer tick. That's the sort of term a lot of people would be familiar with. And then also the dog tick. And each of them presents different threats. I think the one we talk about most is the deer tick. The scientific name of that tick is Ixodes scapularis. That tick can transmit really a wide variety of different pathogens, including things like you're familiar with, Lyme disease, also anaplasmosis. I know there are probably quite a few folks who are listeners who've experienced that or have loved ones who've experienced that. It's another one that can make you quite sick. And then there's some that we see with a lot less frequency. So, for example, there's a virus that's transmitted by those same ticks, too. It's called Powassan virus. There's another kind of bacteria related to Lyme that those ticks can transmit. There's an Ehrlichia. So it's really this kind of terrifying slate of different pathogens that just one tick can transmit. And sometimes they're infected with more than one thing. So it's really important that we have ways to look out for them, which is kind of, Larry, what inspired us to develop the tick app and understand the risks, like what you're doing when you come into contact with those ticks so you can protect yourself from all of those different potential infections.
I've got to admit, I don't have that app on, but I think I'm going to put it on after looking at it. Great. And seeing the information there, and it's a free app.
That's right. Yep. So we developed that app here at the UW with our colleagues in engineering, actually, the Center for Health Engineering Systems, and with some colleagues at Columbia University and also Michigan State University. And we wanted it to be something that would benefit people. So it's available to you all to download for free from either the Apple or the Android stores where you might normally download your apps.
Joan wants to know, can people get Lyme disease from infected pets?
They cannot. So the only way you can get Lyme disease is by having the tick feed on you. And we know that the tick has to feed on you for quite a long time. So it wouldn't be something that you could directly get from your pet.
That's good news.
Yes.
anyway, well, let's talk about symptoms. Now, symptoms, the Lyme disease one, is it always this target or shape on the skin that predicts it?
The target's really informative. If you have the target, that's a great sign that you're in need of some antibiotics. But no, not everybody sees the target. Not everybody gets the target. So, on very fair skin in a really obvious place, you might see that target. On darker skin, you might never see it. And, maybe it's on your back and you're not looking in the mirror that way, so you wouldn't ever find it. So it's really informative if it's there, but if you don't see it, that doesn't mean you don't potentially have it, right?
Martha emailed that her daughter is worried about the safety of giving her dog oral tick, flea, and heartworm medications versus applications that go on the skin. They live in the deer and wood tick capital of Wisconsin. So oral.
Yeah. I think the oral drug that we often use for protecting pets from ticks, usually there's a combination of things in those oral meds. So you might get an oral medication that has a heartworm preventative and a roundworm and a tapeworm preventative and then a flea and tick preventative too. And the safety of those drugs is really excellent. So I feel really good about putting those, giving those to my dogs. I'm a dog woman. I have three dogs myself, and happily use those because they're quite safe for the dogs that I have. So just like you were talking about with Dr. Walter, Larry, there may be some pet breeds that are different, and so you'd really want to talk with your veterinarian and make sure that those drugs are safe for the breed of dog that you have. But generally, the safety of those drugs is really excellent. And I also use the topicals on my dogs to keep ticks off of them. I think those also work really well, and they're quite safe. They're just messier, so the dog's fur looks sort of slicked back for a few days after you put that on them. But whatever you do, I think it's really important that you choose one or the other with your veterinarian's consultation, because things like Lyme disease can make a dog really sick. And Larry, I actually have a little dog. I'm an entomologist, and the dog I have is called a Bug. It's a Boston Terrier Pug mix. And she got Lyme and went limp in both one of her front and one of her back legs, and was really, really sick. So I can't recommend those preventatives enough. You don't want your dog to get Lyme.
No. James in Wausau has something. Let's go there. Hi, James.
Hi. I just wanted to relate that I had babesiosis from a tick bite last June, and people usually don't mention that one. And it's a parasitic disease. It acts very much like malaria, and they treat it with malaria medication. And I'm also, I was in the hospital for 4 days before they finally identified it.
James, wow. Thank you so much for sharing your story. It's so important that people know about babesiosis. It's another one of those things that the deer tick, the Lyme disease tick, can also transmit. And as you said, it's very much like a malaria parasite. So it's different than the bacteria that cause Lyme disease. It's one that gets right inside your red blood cells. And you can imagine, Larry, if a parasite's in your red blood cells, it would make you really, really sick. So so thanks, James, for pointing that out. Another really good reason to do everything you can to prevent being bitten by a tick.
James, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Our guest today, Professor Lyric Bartholomew, is a UW-Madison professor in the School of Veterinary Medicine, studies mosquitoes and ticks and the infectious disease agents they transmit. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at ticks and the research and work that's going on to help us better deal with them with our guest, Lyric Bartholomew from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. It's great to have her back with us. And you, again, can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Dave in Springbrook has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Yeah, I'm enjoying your show, and I'd like to say a comment about babesiosis. I, too, was diagnosed with that a few years ago, and how they diagnosed that was I'm a regular donor to Red Cross to give blood, and they screened my blood and said, "Whoop, can't take it this time."
Right? Wow.
And they told me why, and it kind of caught me off guard because I had absolutely zero symptoms.
Mm. Wow.
I mean, I just felt normal.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Anyway, so little incentive to go give blood. Get a free drug scan.
Thanks, Dave.
Dave, thank you very much for calling. Well, Carl in Plymouth will give you a chance. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I was calling about, I heard your show, and I was just calling about our cat, probably 10 years old, is inside, outside, and I found probably five or six black-legged, you know, super small ticks on her within a day. It's always around her face. She has some really thick fur otherwise. And, considering a treatment for that, some sort of treatment to prevent that. But I was also wondering, I work in agriculture, and we use garlic salt as for cattle. Keeps the ticks and flies off incredibly well. And I don't know, can get the cat to eat that. have you heard of anything like that? Because cows and animals will eat it like crazy because they need the mineral. But the garlic is incredible.
Not so good for the cats don't like it.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Well, cats certainly can get really infested, we would say, with ticks. And so that's where I've seen them on cats, too, is around their noses, Carl. And so, you'll want to get those off of your cat, or do talk to your veterinarian, too, about what medications might be good for keeping the ticks off of your cat. Sometimes they're different than the ones you can safely give dogs. So, so good on you for that. And the garlic salt is really interesting. There are a lot of folks who have said, a variety of things are that you could add to your diet to make you more repellent to different bloodsuckers. And I hadn't heard that garlic salt one yet, but that's really interesting. I think what it points out is that we really need ways to keep these things off of us, and for people at least, the best ways to do that would be to use EPA-registered repellents, and that would be things that have like 20% or 30% DEET in them or picaridin. Knowing that there's a risk, seeing them on your cat alerts you to the fact that the ticks are out, and to keep them off of yourself too.
And this is the time of year for this, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. And so, Larry, the ticks that transmit things like babesiosis that our two callers mentioned, and the Lyme disease bacteria, are these deer ticks. And the particular life stage that does it is the nymph stage. So we kind of call that the teenager stage. The nymph stage is really small. And so you may have seen a few years ago the CDC had some campaign for keeping yourself safe from ticks that had a poppy seed muffin with ticks on it. And that was to remind us that the size of these ticks is so tiny. It's really like the size of a poppy seed. And so those are out and active right now, and they're really hard to detect. So being alert to that possibility is really important.
Yeah. Leslie in Cottage Grove called to ask, couldn't stay with us, wondering if diatomaceous earth will keep her chickens tick-free if using diatomaceous earth.
Yeah, I think in the poultry realm, there's a lot of use of things like diatomaceous earth to keep all kinds of lice and other things off of poultry. And interestingly, Larry, right now there's a graduate student in the lab who's working on something like diatomaceous earth as a potential to keep ticks away. So we're doing that research to see if that might also, keep people and other pets safe.
You think global warming is playing a role in the spread of ticks?
You know, with ticks, the equation's not as simple as, you know, temperature changes equating to more ticks. They're really reliant on having particular hosts. So they've got to have mice to feed on in their early stages, and they've got to have deer to feed on. So the extent of ticks is really limited by where their hosts are. But I would say warmer temperatures make for tick activity maybe lasting longer in the fall and starting up sooner in the spring. So it might not mean more ticks overall, more numbers, but it could mean more times of the year when there's a possibility we'd encounter them.
Yeah. Wow. And we haven't talked about mosquitoes at all, but how do you tell if your pet might have a mosquito-borne illness?
Yeah, the big one that we worry about around here in terms of mosquito-borne diseases is heartworm. So it's another one of those things where it's really great to use preventatives, because a dog that gets heartworm is really, really sick, and cats can get really sick from this too. So, Larry, it's another moment to just say that, you know, these oral drugs that you can give your pets can protect them from fleas, ticks, mosquitoes, and the parasites that mosquitoes might cause. So it's not one that you want your dog to ever get.
Yeah, for sure. And that app, that tick app, let's go back to that again.
Yeah.
Because where do we get that? You can get it at, here at wpr.org/Larry. We'll give you the spot, but... Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have a website associated with the tick app. So look up tick app, all one word, and you can find us that way and find a link to download it. And also you can find it in the Apple iTunes store. That's probably not what it's called, Larry, but, you know, the Apple store where you download apps, and also the app store for Android phones. So freely available in those places. And we'd be really, really grateful to have folks join on and tell us when they're encountering ticks, and send us photos of your tick, and we can let you know what you've encountered.
And last, Andy wonders, are we going to get that vaccination for Lyme disease?
Yeah, thanks, Andy, for that question. I think the prospects are good. It's kind of promising, I would say. Right now, there's a Lyme disease vaccine that's in what's called the third phase of clinical trials, and the companies that are working on that are hopeful that it might be as soon as 2026 that we could see a Lyme disease vaccine again.
Be nice to have. Mm-hmm. Lyric, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It flew by.
We'll Ticks don't back. Fly, Larry, but I do.
Oh, man. Lyric Bartholomew is UW-Madison professor in the School of Veterinary Medicine. It's great to have her with us. And we will get her back. We'll do it again. Just quickly remember, we have a one-day member drive coming up on Thursday. You don't have to wait, though. You can give right now and get one of our thank you gifts. We've got a Badger tote. We've got a WPR Badger koozie. You can get both of them. Go to wpr.org/donate, and you can have one of those. And a big thanks again to Lyric, of course, and our other guests today, and also to our team. Lee Rayburn's our technical director. Jeff Robbins is also one of our technical directors. And Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, our producers. Executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.